This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Even though he had essentially promised to do it during his campaign, and even though every action he's taken during the first few months of his presidency has shown his determination to cancel every effort his predecessor made to address the climate crisis, President Trump's blunt cancellation last week of America's commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement was met with consternation, outrage, and even accusations of criminality from around the world. By withdrawing from the accord, Trump isolated the United States from the international community, leaving the U.S. in the company of only Syria and Nicaragua as the only non-participants in the pact to turn around a climate calamity largely of its own making. And Nicaragua only refused to sign on because its leader felt the agreement didn't go far enough to address the severity of the crisis. In that assessment, none could agree more than truthout.org columnist Dar Jamail, the award-winning investigative journalist and Port Townsend resident who made his mark as the rare non-embedded American journalist in the war in Iraq, and who is now focusing almost entirely on the climate crisis in his work as he prepares the manuscript for his upcoming book, The End of Ice. I spoke with Jamail last Wednesday as the world was waiting anxiously to find out which influence would prove more powerful, that of President Trump's own family, many heads of state, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and many corporate supporters of climate action, including ExxonMobil, who were all pressing him to keep faith with the Paris Accord, or those to whom he had promised a continuation of the polluting business as usual in his campaign, including the coal lobby. So now let's go inside the compass. Okay, so I'm sitting here talking to Truthout journalist Dar Jamail, who over the last several years has been really dedicating himself to issues of climate disruption and is working on a book on the subject. Isn't that right? What's the name of the book?
That's right. The book is called The End of Ice. It's going to be published by the New Press next year, and it's a book about abrupt climate change, but written from a very first-person visceral perspective of going to a lot of the places where some of the most dramatic changes are already happening.
So you just were telling me that you've been doing a lot of traveling and you're doing a lot more traveling over the next month, and we'll talk about some of the places you've been and where you're going and why. This is also, we're sort of today at a historic juncture. We've heard that President Trump is about to make an announcement about pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. And what does this represent to you?
Well, I'll talk about the Paris Accord or the Paris Agreement. You know, in 2015, in December, world leaders met in Paris to, and the vast majority of them, nearly 200 countries have signed on to it. And it's basically an agreement to aim to prevent the Earth from heating up by 2 degrees C. And we've already warmed the planet to 1.1 C, but its goal is to keep it from reaching 2 C, because that is the politically agreed upon target, which cannot be passed. Otherwise, we go into catastrophic climate disruption, basically runaway climate disruption. And there's problems with the Paris Agreement in that I've been very, very critical of it, because James Hansen of NASA Goddard, formerly of NASA Goddard, has released a paper several years ago at this point that shows that 1 C is the point that we actually reach runaway climate disruption, and we've already hit that point. And
so, in other words, we're already seeing runaway climate disruption.
We're already in it, and we'll get into that here in a minute. But the thing is, with the Trump administration and Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of that, it's largely a symbolic act. But that said, it is a, I just published a story this morning on this for Truth Out, and I called it a callous disregard for life and the planet. And I think that's accurate. I think that's what we're looking at. It's just this thumbing of his nose at the future of the planet, the future of people being born, the future of younger people, of all of us, that we are in a crisis and it's just a throwing more fuel on the fire. It's just a blatant nod to the fossil fuel industry that's backing him along with all these other interests.
This comes at an amazing moment too. I mean, like, you know, all of the recent news reports that have come out. I subscribe to EE News and I get something called Climate Wire. And just yesterday I was reading a recent post from them about the runaway melting of the Greenland ice sheet. That is, and maybe you could cite those figures better than me, but as I recall, it was something like it's going 7 or 8 times faster than they thought it would.
That's accurate. And I'm going to talk about Greenland and the Antarctic in relation to sea level rise. This is something that here for us in Port Townsend, we are going to be experiencing very, very directly, much more so than some of the other impacts. So when we talk about Greenland and the Antarctic, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the UN authority that governments use their projections in order to try to plan and prepare, mitigate, and make adaptation plans for what's coming. So in regards to temperature rise, to projected sea level rise, to project other types of projections. And so when we talk about sea level rise, it's impossible to talk about this without talking directly to Greenland and Antarctica. And what you said is it's happening multiple times faster than anyone thought it was, even just a few years ago. And recent studies are coming in on Antarctica showing a similar phenomena where the melting is in runaway stage in a lot of areas of the Antarctic already, and certainly around the brunt of Greenland. And so what the problem with this is the IPCC, and this is what I've been learning and researching my book and just talking with some of the two of the preeminent sea level rise experts on the planet down out of University of Miami in Florida, Dr. Ben Kirtman, who is an IPCC author, as well as works with NOAA and one of the leading forecasters in the world, and Dr. Hal Wassman, also with University of Miami. And they both point out that the IPCC does not factor in enough for sea level rise in regards to melting of the Greenland ice sheet, as well as the melting in Antarctica. They're literally, they account for it, but the percentage of the factor of sea level rise input that they account for those is almost laughable. And so what that means is that their sea level rise projections are extremely skewed. And so, for example,
On the conservative side.
So the worst case projections the IPCC gives for sea level rise is 6 feet by 2100. NOAA came out with a report this January that raised that to 8 feet by 2100. And Harold Wanless, who I mispronounced his name earlier, but Harold Wanless, University of Miami, he's a department chair there, a climate scientist and a geologist, and has been studying sea level rise and is on all of these boards in South Florida trying to get people prepared for what's coming there. He said, actually, we could easily see not just 10 feet, not just 16 feet, but possibly even upwards of 20 feet by 2100.
Now, that means 6 or 8 feet comes a lot earlier, right?
A lot earlier. In fact, James, he spoke with me and reminded me of the fact that James Hansen also published a paper just a couple of years ago saying it's absolutely not out of the realm of possibility, given how exponential everything is going, that we could easily see 10 feet by 2050.
All right, so 6 feet, 8 feet, 10 or 20 feet. Give me an idea of what that means in terms of, like, population disruptions around the planet. I mean, you know, like, I don't know. Let's take the conservative figure of just 6 feet.
I'll take the conservative figure of 4 feet. I just got back from Florida just about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, researching my chapter for sea level rise. And looking statistically just at that as a case study. So 4 feet means almost half. About 44% of Miami-Dade County is underwater at 4 feet. When you go up to 6 feet, you go up to 10 feet, you're looking at population in South Florida, roughly 2.5 million people that will be displaced. That's absolutely going to happen in advance of 2100. There's no question about that.
That's just in South Florida.
And that's just in South Florida. Let me give you another example, talking about 2 feet. So Dr. Wanless had explained to me that if we, once we hit 2 feet, that's enough to essentially overtake all of the barrier islands on the planet. Not that that's enough to cover them, because it's not, but that's enough that that much sea level rise plus tides plus storm surge plus overwash means that in a short order of time, all barrier islands on the planet will go away. So, for example, Miami Beach is on a barrier island that's already importing 100% of its water from the mainland. Add 2 feet to that, Miami Beach is gone. I interviewed the city engineer of Miami Beach. He said they've had 5 inches of sea level rise in the last 3 years. So it's happening pretty quick. But then if we look at other population centers, like, for example, Mumbai, it's built on barrier island and floodplain. 2 feet, 30 million people, where do they go? And start doing the math. New Orleans, other eastern seaboard countries in the U.S., parts of L.A., Tokyo, Shanghai, Jakarta, start going around the globe. We're looking at just 2 feet sea level rise, tens of millions of people. Where are they going to go? That's a problem.
And what are the city planners in all of these places doing about it? I mean, I know that in Florida, the government officials are notoriously trying to turn their heads and not look.
Well, Florida is a very complicated place, and it's fascinating. And in a way, it's a micro of the macro that is the entire country. So you've got Governor Rick Scott of Florida, lunatic climate disruption denier, literally will not allow any state employee to write or speak the words climate change or global warming. Yet, when you go down to South Florida, where people are already taking it on the chin on a daily basis, every mayor of every municipality in Miami-Dade County, so you're talking dozens of mayors, Republican and Democrat alike, and every state congressperson in South Florida, save one Republican, meaning all the other Republican representatives of the entirety of South Florida, have all signed petitions and letters begging the governor to acknowledge it and to give them the funding they need to deal with sewage issues, road issues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there is no debate in South Florida where people are already wading through water at times, and where some places are already having to not be used because of sea level rise, and people are already starting to try to sell their homes. So it's not a debate. And yet it's in this against this backdrop of a denialist governor, along with a real estate market in the greater Miami, and particularly the Miami Beach area, that is still booming, despite the fact that you've already got, for example, last fall during a king tide and a big rain event in an area where they'd raised the streets in Miami Beach 2.5 feet. So that city's already undergoing a $500 million project to raise all their streets 2.5 feet, to buy them 20 to 30 years. To prepare for the worst that's coming. And yet in one of those areas during a king tide and a major rain event last fall, one of these bazillion-dollar condo high-rise projects, the first floor flooded. And so they went to their insurance company and said, hey, okay, we need some help. And the insurance company said, actually, we don't have to insure you now, because technically that's not a first floor, that's a basement. So where's this going to go?
So you mentioned Port Townsend briefly earlier, the fact that we're in a waterfront town. And I recall a big storm last winter when I was standing looking at the storm surge along the backs of the buildings facing the water on Water Street. And there were big waves breaking against the bases of the buildings here. Now, what are we expecting in a few years' time?
Well, it's going to, I think, be more than a few years. The sea level rise is, in the U.S., it's the most pronounced on the eastern seaboard. Dr. Kirtman explained this to me in great detail, all the different factors at work, and why is it that the eastern seaboard is taking it far more on the chin than, say, along the Gulf of Mexico or certainly the West Coast. And I won't get into that here. It's a bit detailed, but in short, we are going to see it a little bit more slowly than they are. But that said, once rise gets to, say, 3-4 feet globally, here, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of imagination. Just go walk down out on some of those piers or walk down on some of the beaches there, like, say, nearby Better Living Through Coffee, one of my favorite places, and just envision it. Go down there at high tide and then add 3-4 feet to that and see what you think. Where does that water go? And you can start to see, well, it's, you know, 3-4 feet is going to start getting you up into some of these buildings, or at least right at their doorsteps, and then add in some storms and some wind and, maybe some, you know, some big rain events and some other extreme events. And then we start to have some real problems. And
well, so, I mean, Better Living Through Coffee was one of the places I went that day, and I have video of waves, splashing up to the tops of the windows. I mean, you know, like, I mean, it was spray. It wasn't actually the full force of the wave breaking against the window. Mm-hmm. But there was seawater regularly, you know, hitting to the top of the window. And it was easy to imagine it being worse.
Right. And so the question then is, yeah, so when do we get that 3 or 4 feet? And, you know, the question is not if, it's when. And again, if you believe James Hansen, and I think most people listening to this are probably familiar with who that is, and so his report of calling for 10 feet by 2050, you know, we're 2017, we're talking 33 years. That's not long. And if it's 10 feet by then, it's going to be 5 feet a lot sooner than that. So then the question is, you know, does Port Townsend end up looking like Miami Beach and kind of doing half measures and, you know, being aware that there's a problem and maybe taking a little bit of action towards it? Or are we going to start dealing with the reality that we're facing, that we're looking at catastrophic levels of sea level rise around the planet well in advance of 2100? And so does it make sense to make kind of half measure plans or start really looking squarely at the issue and behaving like an adult?
What does that mean to you? How do we behave like adults? What is the adult behavior that you would seek? If everything suddenly went right, what would that look like?
Well, that's exactly what I asked Harold Wanless, University of Miami, you know, one of the leading sea level rise modelers on the planet. And he said, first of all, any politician that's not talking about this honestly is being criminally negligent. So let's start there. And what he and Kurtman and a lot of the other leadership in South Miami, who are already taking it on the chin, what they're doing is they are openly petitioning politicians to start releasing state and federal fundings to start relocation projects for people that are already in low-lying areas, i.e. start using government money to buy them out of their houses and helping them figure out where they're going to relocate, because they're acutely aware that the brunt of South Florida is going to have to be relocated. It's not if, it's when. And we need to start dealing with that as in a very adult, orderly fashion before it's just an outright emergency crisis and there's chaos and people are just running. Because right now, by being negligent and acting like that's not going to happen or that's something so far off into the future, we're just not going to have to deal with it. So let's just let our kids worry about that. Why not be responsible and deal with it now? And first of all, acknowledging the reality of how far along we really are. And I'm just the messenger. I'm just reporting the latest science here. This is not my opinion. This is what I'm getting directly from the experts that I'm talking with in the field. And so I'm going to listen to what they're saying. And I think that it makes sense. If I'm in charge of a city, especially a coastal city, I damn well better be listening to what they're saying and behaving accordingly. And so that means, first of all, informing the people that I'm responsible for and the people that I might have some leverage to affect their lives in a positive way, then I should probably be honest and behave accordingly.
I'm talking with Dar Jamail, who is a reporter for Truth Out and also an investigative reporter who's won awards for his work as a non-embedded reporter in Iraq, and also has done work investigating the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and now is working on his book, The End of Ice. His most recent work has been about climate disruption. Well, we've been talking about sea level rise, but there are a lot of other effects of climate disruption that could prove to be more than the major inconvenience that sea level rise is going to present for all of those people who have to, like, you know, relocate someplace else. I think we could call that a major inconvenience. But there was something I read in one of your recent articles about oxygen in the oceans and the environmental, the ecological implications of that. Could you talk a little about that?
Dissolved oxygen in the oceans. There was a recent study that came out, and that's why I brought that into the lead of one of my recent my most recent climate dispatch. And it's a very important subject, and I think, you know, people's first thoughts, I presume that most of the listenership who's read about climate disruption and is aware of Earth's previous mass extinction events, that should send up warning flags. The study, in short, showed that the amount of dissolved oxygen in the oceans is decreasing far more rapidly than previously believed. And that's worrisome because that was a precipitating factor in the Permian mass extinction event, which was the single largest mass extinction event in the planet's history. It took place 250 million years ago and wiped out roughly 90% of all life on Earth. And it was so devastating because of what happened in the oceans, and that we're basically starting to see that, the beginnings of that now. It's not news that we are officially in the sixth mass extinction event in the planet's history. There have been several now peer-reviewed scientific reports come out speaking to that. It's not news that we are living in the Anthropocene, an era of the planet's history where it's literally, the planet's literally being shaped by humans, hence the name. And so when these types of reports are coming out again, it's just more reason to take notice. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, there's so many other impacts in addition to sea level rise. And what's interesting is when I was just down in South Florida talking to these people and, you know, getting that this is a huge crisis. Everything that we just discussed makes that clear. And yet even these people that I was speaking with, some of these leading authorities on the subject, said actually, but sea level rise is probably one of the easier impacts of climate disruption to deal with because we can see it coming and we do have time to get people out of the way. But what happens when all of a sudden the glaciers in the Himalaya that more than a billion people between India and China rely upon as their primary water source, when those are gone at well in advance of 2100, where do those people get their water? What happens when I talked with NASA scientist Ira Lifer, and he was critiquing the most recently published IPCC assessment, and he says, look, even that assessment, as conservative as it is talking about shifting global rainfall patterns. So what happens when North Africa stops getting rain? Well, we're talking about then a report that the UN released a few months ago that said, well in advance of 2100, North Africa and the entire Middle East, a place where almost half a billion people lived, literally becomes unlivable because there's not enough water. So these are the scenarios that we're looking at. And, you know, these rain events and the drought events, like what we've already seen flashes of them up until, you know, this winter, California's been in severe drought. According to NASA, they're still actually in a mega drought. This is just kind of a blip back into a little bit of water, but it will ultimately go back into drought. And, you know, a couple of years of really deep drought, and we see what it does here. And we've seen that evidence of that here in the United States. So, again, when we start talking about water availability and food availability, things that can change very quickly, then the crisis can be upon us. Not we're talking about waiting until 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050, but we're talking about that stuff that can change things on a dime. So, you know, literally in a year or two's time, you know, a couple of big events like that happen, and we start seeing some major disruptions right here at home.
You were telling me that you're about to go down to Oregon and California, and you're looking at forestry. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what you expect to see on that trip.
Well, I'm doing a chapter on trees in the book, because what's happening with trees is also a very dramatic situation, and it's not getting a lot of attention. And then I'm also going to go to Glacier National Park for the obvious reasons. I'm going to meet with Dan Fager there, one of the leading glaciologists in the country, and he was recently in the media. There was a big media flurry because he came out and said, look, Glacier National Park is down to basically roughly 26 glaciers, and those will be gone.
Out of?
There used to be well over 100. I don't remember the exact number, but it was comfortably over 100, but down to 26, and that he also was part of another report that came out and showed that by 2050, there will be no glaciers anywhere in the contiguous 48 United States. So that includes us here. So
that includes the Olympics.
That includes the Olympics. That includes the Cascades. That includes the entire lower 48. So these 48 states by 2050. And so again, that's going to affect farming. That's going to affect irrigation. That's going to affect a lot of people's water sources, not even to speak of recreation. You know, and the thing is, too, about glaciers is when we talk about the loss of glaciers, and this is where it ties into trees, to get back to your original question, is glaciers have their own role in the ecology of where they are, certainly with trees and animals. So if you remove the primary water source for that ecological system, then that whole system's going to be in big trouble. So we're talking about, you know, major tree shifts, namely going away, other types, and then, you know, flora and fauna are all going to be very, very dramatically affected. And that's another thing I'm going to be talking with Dan Fager about up in Glacier National Park.
Well, we're about to run out of time here, but there's a question that I asked you the last time we talked about this, and I'll ask it again. I mean, well, I'll ask it this way. Is your book going to find a way to end on a hopeful note?
The only hope that I have for the book is that people will read it and then realize the importance of the fact that we have allowed ourselves in general in this country to become so disconnected from nature, and that they will remember, okay, what's my favorite place to go in nature, because I need to go spend time in that place right now, because things are changing and going away so rapidly that it's not about how are we going to mitigate, you know, obviously everyone agrees we're not going to stop what's happening. The only argument is, can we still mitigate it or not? And I'm just simply urging people, go be in nature now while you can.
Dar Jamil's book, The End of Ice, is due for publication in early 2018. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. You can listen to today's program and podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.